Ed Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. Children in Peril, and two organizations that are working to pull them out of trouble and help them find their way to a fulfilling life. We start by replaying an interview Margot Patterson did with Tracy McClard about her son, who at 17 committed suicide after being sent to an adult prison. She will also talk about her organization, Family and Friends, Organizing for Reform of Juvenile Justice. Then, host Melvin Merritt speaks with Dr. Madeline Douglas, Director of Residential and Administrative Services at Niles Home for Children. She will bring us up to date with their programs and opportunities for at-risk youth. There will be no calendar of events this week, but we will be playing the 420 Drug War News at the end of the show. We also want to thank today's engineer, Jen Zaman. Stay tuned for Margot and Tracy McClard.
This is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. 10,000 children under the age of 18 are incarcerated in adult jails and prisons in the United States, where an estimated 250,000 youth go before the adult criminal court every year. According to the National Juvenile Justice Network, in some states, children as young as 13 are rubbing shoulders with seasoned criminals. This occurs, though the research shows that prosecuting children as adults does not improve public safety and, in fact, increases the risks that youths will reoffend. It also places youths jailed in adult prisons at significant risk of rape and other types of mental and physical harm and leaves them without access to education. The treatment accorded juvenile offenders, especially those in adult prisons, is the subject of today's interview. My guest is Tracy McClard, the founder of Families and Friends, Organizing for Reform of Juvenile Justice. FORGE is dedicated to ending the practice of placing children and youth under the age of 18 in Missouri's jails and prisons. It also advocates that all children in Missouri's juvenile or adult criminal justice system be provided the necessary rehabilitation needed to become productive members of society when they leave. Tracy McClard, welcome.
Hi, and thank you for having me.
Tracy, I'm wondering if we could begin by talking about your family's experience, because it's that experience that prompted you to establish FORGE. And here, let me mention that Tracy is the mother of Jonathan McClard, who tragically died in prison at age 17, 7 weeks after he was sentenced to 30 years in a maximum security prison in Missouri. Tracy, how did that event lead you to what you're doing today?
Well, obviously it was one of the most horrible things that could happen to a person in their entire lifetime. Not only are you losing your child, but you're losing total control of what happens to your child. You can't see them. You can't talk to them. You can't send them things. There is a wall that goes up as soon as they are arrested and you are shut out. So I had never had this type of experience with our justice system before, and I remember thinking that as things progressed, I was just shocked over and over and over again that the United States of America is treating our children and our families this way by throwing our children away and allowing them to be abused and totally shutting the families out so that there's nothing that we can do about it and it's legal.
I was very surprised to learn some of what you've said. You mentioned that Jonathan was transferred something like 8 times during 6 months, and you had no idea where he was.
Exactly.
And I take it this is very common. Is this the rule in most states?
I can't speak of other states. I do federal work, but Missouri is the only state that I know the law as well as I do. But I do work with other parents across the nation, and they have all said the same things. It's pretty common.
And why is it important, you think, that juveniles convicted in adult court serve their sentence in juvenile facilities rather than adult prisons?
Well, to start with, I don't think any child should ever be tried as an adult or placed in adult court. But Missouri does have a facility in Montgomery City for kids who are tried as adults, for kids who have committed more serious offenses. The difference between that facility and the juvenile facilities as compared to being put in the adult system is in juvenile facilities, the whole outlook for children is to give them a second chance of being a productive member of society. Everything that caused them to run afoul of the law is treated within the juvenile system. They get their education, they get mental health services, they get counseling, they get victim empathy. If they have a drug problem, which the majority of children who run across the juvenile justice system have some sort of drug issue, that is, all of those pieces are put together with total family involvement. And in Missouri's dual jurisdiction program, which does treat children as adults within their one facility, their success rate is so high that it has gotten an award from Harvard University. It's renowned across Missouri and other countries that try to copy it. If you place a child in an adult court or house them in an adult jail or an adult prison, they receive no services at all. They have no mental health services, no drug rehab services, no education. Any type of service that you can think of, it is not geared towards youth and it does not work. Besides that, youth who are held in adult court are 36 times more likely to commit suicide, as is what happened to my son. They die either physically or mentally because, one, they are put with the general population where they're targeted for physical or sexual abuse, or to keep them safe, they are put in isolation where their mental health plummets and suicide is a high rate because it's considered a form of torture. And there is another movement going across the country about solitary confinement, and we're putting our youth in solitary confinement, and it's disgusting. In the juvenile facility, youth are given everything they could possibly need to become productive members of society again. Youth are highly amenable to rehabilitation, and Missouri has a really good program in their juvenile services run by the Department of Youth Services, as well as the same program is called the Dual Jurisdiction Program, and it is for kids who have been certified as an adult, and they can receive the same juvenile services as kids who have remained in the juvenile system.
I think some people may not be familiar, I wasn't, with that phrase, certified as adults, and what it means. Could you say a little bit about what it does mean and how the process works?
Sure. Each state calls it something different, but in Missouri, it is called certification as an adult. And what it means is if a child does a more serious crime, then they are in danger of being tried as an adult. That means they will go before a juvenile judge, and the judge will take them out of the juvenile system and refer them to the adult system, where they will go before an adult judge and be tried as an adult. And when that happens, you as a parent and their family can no longer be privy to what they and their lawyer talk about, because now they are an adult. It doesn't matter how young they are. In Missouri, we can certify children as adults, put them in adult court as young as 12. There is a loophole in Missouri that can plummet that age as low as possible. Right now, we have 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds in adult jails in Missouri. And 17-year-olds in Missouri are considered adults. So they're not being certified as an adult because in Missouri they're already considered adults. So it doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter how minor it is. They immediately go to the adult court. And once you are in an adult court, especially with a felony, then it makes it very hard once you get out of that system for a child, because they now have a felony record, to get a loan for college, to rent an apartment, to get a loan for a car or a home. Any of those normal things that you would normally do as you grow up, you can't do. There's always a block that will be there.
Well, it seems shocking to me that children 12, 13, 14 could be tried as adults. Has that been the case for decades? What is the conceivable rationale for that?
It started happening in the mid-90s. There were a couple of high-profile cases in the 90s that for some reason just blew up in the media. And this term called super predator came out, and it was supposed to refer to these children who were ganging up together and just going out to attack anybody. And the funny thing is, that never surfaced. Nothing like that ever happened. But all across the state, it was like wildfire. All of these laws started changing, calling it tough on crime and making it really, really easy to put our children in the adult court system.
If I understand correctly, the pre-detention of youth in adult facilities is also of concern to you and your organization. That is, youth who, before they go to trial, are being held. What are the conditions that youth face in those facilities?
What happens is when a child is in, when they're first arrested, they're in the juvenile facility, but the day that they are certified as an adult, they go straight from the courtroom to the adult jail, which is what happened to Jonathan. When he was there, our visits dropped to once a week, and he was behind glass, and we had to talk to him on a phone. And when we spoke to him, he would talk about how the lights were on all the time, and all the adults were up all night, and he would try to take his shower in mid-morning when they were all asleep, so he wasn't in danger of being assaulted. He was really, really intelligent. This happened to him right after his sophomore year of high school. So he tried to study his GED books because he was officially dropped from the high school roster the day that he was certified as an adult. So he wanted to get his GED. But he said that it was just too noisy and nobody cared, and so he said there was no way that I can study for it. And then he moved to another jail facility, and I called and called and called the supervisor of that facility because I was extremely worried about his safety. And I was told, don't worry, you know, we're going to put him with some of the adults down here that we can trust that'll watch over him, blah blah blah. He was moved on a Thursday, and I just kind of figured out the pattern after a while that it seems like they always moved him on Thursday because he, as you said before, he was moved 8 times, but we never knew where he was until he had a chance to get to a phone and call us. And sometimes it was that day, sometimes it was a couple days later. We just never knew. Anyway, so the first night that he was moved to that second jail facility, that was a Thursday. Our first visit was on a Monday. We had to visit between 1 and 4 o'clock for 15 minutes through glass. And the first time we went to visit was the Monday after he had been there a few days. And what we saw was a beaten and bruised boy. His hair was shaved off. He had a teardrop tattoo that he was told he needed to survive. And all he said was, don't worry about me, Mom. I'm the one that got me into this, and you just don't worry about me.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio, and if you're just tuning in, I'm here talking to Tracy McClard, the founder of Families and Friends, Organizing for Reform of Juvenile Justice. Tracy, you were just talking about Jonathan. Could you tell a little bit about the tragic circumstances that led to his incarceration?
Sure. He had gotten involved with this girl about a year before this happened, in the fall of 2006. And he just loved her to death. He just thought she was the greatest. And she was. She was, you know, she came from a very difficult family life, but she spent a lot of time at our house, and we grew to love her, too. So they dated, you know, through his sophomore year of high school. She was a couple years younger than he was. She was 14. And in May of the following year, in May of 2007, I left because I was in the Army at the time, and I had to go for training in another state. And when I left him, he was really looking forward to colleges and scholarships. So we went to the high school graduation that year just to see what all the different scholarships were that he could get. And that's how I left him, and he was happy. After I was gone for a couple of weeks, I was going to be gone for, I think it was 7 weeks that summer, because I was going to be back on July 13th. Yeah. So after I had been gone for a couple of weeks, I would talk to him every night. And you know, one time he said, well, you know, she broke up with me. And I said, well, sweetheart, I'm really sorry. And I said, are you okay? And he said, well, I'm really bummed out. But, you know, he was okay with it at first. I mean, he was really bummed out, like any 16-year-old would be that lost his girlfriend, but that he just thought was so all was it. But he was okay. But then after a couple weeks, the conversation started to change. She had gotten a new boyfriend, and he started to say, Mom, you know, he's beating her up. Mom, he's raping her. Mom, he's forcing her to do cocaine. Mom, he's doing this. Mom, he's doing that. And I was like, Jonathan, that doesn't even make sense, because you know her and she would not let him do this. If this was happening, you know, she wouldn't be with him. But he believed all of this was happening. He thoroughly believed all of this was happening. So on July the 10th, he got a phone call from her that morning. And they had gotten together a couple weeks before and slept together. And she called and told him that she was pregnant and that the new boyfriend was going to force her to shoot up cocaine to kill the baby, but that she was going to commit suicide before that could happen. So in his mind, he was thinking that two people's lives are in danger. So he called the boyfriend, and, you know, I don't know how that happened. But anyway, later that day, they both ended up at the car wash, and Jonathan ended up shooting the ex-boyfriend 3 times. Told me from the very beginning that I only wanted to scare him, and the police will understand why I did what I did, because I'm saving 2 lives. I'm saving a baby, which there never was a baby. But I am not blaming the girl, and I am not blaming the other boyfriend. It's just, you know, and there were drugs involved, because Jonathan started doing these at the time, and they're probably still calling it triple C's, but it was a new type of drug, and it was, you can take over-the-counter Coricidin D, which has dextromethorphan in it, and you can build up the amount that you take to where you don't feel anything. And so he started doing that over the summer so he wouldn't feel anything. And so the day that he shot this boy, he just was not there, you know.
I know that this past year in 2013, Forge was instrumental in helping the passage in Missouri of Jonathan's Law, named yes. after your son. What does Jonathan's Law mandate?
So it deals directly with the dual jurisdiction program, which is the program I spoke of earlier for kids who have been placed in the adult system, kids that have done a more serious crime. The boy that Jonathan shot did not die, thankfully. Right after the incident, I had this overwhelming urge to pray for my son, and my husband had the overwhelming urge to pray for the boy that Jonathan shot. And he survived. So to get into the dual jurisdiction program, not only does a child have to be certified as an adult, but a staff member of the Department of Youth Services will come and interview your child. It's about a 2-hour interview, and they will give a recommendation to the court of, yes, we want this child in our program, or no, we don't think it's a good fit. And the Department of Youth Services generally, I mean, they accept just about all children. I think they've denied 2 since the mid-90s when it was started. Jonathan was highly recommended for the program because he just had goals. He had things going for him. He had a lot of friends. He did so well in school. And the person that interviewed him told me, he said, "Tracy, he's already rehabilitated. He knows what he did was wrong, and he's got so many goals." He said, "You know, I really hope they let us have him, but the court jurisdiction that he's in generally are hard for us to work with." So that was the recommendation from DYS. That's where Jonathan should have gone. But that day that we went to court, a representative from DYS actually came to court. His name was Brent Burek, and tried to talk the judge into letting Jonathan into their program. And I found out later that normally a DYS rep doesn't come. They just send the recommendation in the letter. But in this case, he came, and the judge would not listen to a thing he said. And the judge said, "I am not going to let him go in 10 years, or I'm not going to let him go in 4 years. I'm not going to let him go in 10 years. I'm not going to let him go." He said, "I am a statistic that program does not work. I was the first judge in the state of Missouri to sentence a child to the dual jurisdiction program. That child left the state, went to Chicago, and shot somebody else. So I will never, ever sentence another child to the dual jurisdiction program." So the dual jurisdiction program has a 93% success rate to start off with. The second thing I found out about a year and a half ago is the judge lied, because they went back and tried to find that youth that the judge was talking about that went to Chicago and shot somebody else, and that child doesn't exist. So Jonathan ended up with a 30-year prison sentence, and 7 weeks later, he died.
Is it totally up to the judge then whether a child is certified, well, one, goes into the dual jurisdiction system, but also is certified as an adult? Who decides that?
It's up to the judge. The certification is up to the juvenile judge, and then whether the child goes into the dual jurisdiction program or into the adult Department of Corrections is up to the adult judge. So Jonathan's law, back to that quickly, is it addressed three things about dual jurisdiction that kept Jonathan out. One is all judges have to consider dual jurisdiction as an option, and that's more of an education piece, because there are a lot of jurisdictions in Missouri that aren't aware that we have this excellent program. The second piece is before Jonathan's law, the whole court process had to be done by the child's 17th birthday, which made us feel very, very rushed, because Jonathan committed his crime 6 months before his 17th birthday. So Jonathan's law gives the court an additional 6 months and gives DYS an additional 6 months to get the process done. The third piece is because the judge lied in our case. If a judge goes against the recommendation of DYS, if DYS accepts a child into the program and the judge goes against that, he has to write a finding in court of why he goes against the recommendation of the state child experts.
And is that judge that sentenced Jonathan, is he still on the bench?
Yes. There is a statute in Missouri called Once an Adult, Always an Adult, and it was for all children, no matter if they were ever convicted of a crime or not. All children that were certified as an adult would ever forever have to be in the adult court, no matter what they did after that, whether they, you know, stole a pack of gum out of a store or whatever. So it took all kids who were found not guilty or charges were dropped, they were able, if they ever did something again, they were able to stay in the juvenile system.
Tracy McClard, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Jeff Humfeld, and unfortunately, our guest for the second half of our show has not made it, so we're going to play another piece from our archives. This is Robin Martinez talking with former Wyandotte County Prosecutor Brian Leiniger about the militarization of police.
Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Martinez. I'm a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild and a member of the law firm Martinez, Madrill & Machacow. Today, you're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM. Our topic is the militarization of police forces in the United States. And my guest here today with me in the studio is Brian Leininger. Brian's an attorney who does a lot of criminal defense work here in the Kansas City metropolitan area. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you, Robin.
Militarization of police has become a topic that seems like it's been getting a lot more press lately, with a lot more people having access to cell phone cameras and video cameras. We're starting to see a lot more of what actually happens in a lot of police raids. And it seems like over the past few years, there have been a lot more videos that have gone viral of heavily armed SWAT teams kicking people's doors in. Is this something that's just brand new, or is it something that's been there for a while, or what's the history? Why have the police gotten so militarized and almost looking like they're armies in third world countries?
Well, it's definitely not brand new. It's been around, I'd say, started with the drug war maybe 40 years ago, or really started increasing then. But it's certainly been around a while. I was a prosecutor in the inner city in Wyandotte County in the early 90s. It was certainly alive and well then. I was a young man and went out on a lot of drug raids and stayed in the background while they were doing that very thing over, generally small amounts of drugs. But I think it's just increasing. It's becoming a lot more prevalent. More and more police agencies, and especially smaller towns and smaller police agencies, are getting or have had SWAT teams for a while and are using them a lot more often. If they're going to have them, they're going to use them. So I just think it keeps growing and growing. Now, you're right that it's harder to hide now. Everybody's got a video camera on their cell phone, and it is coming to light a lot more, and I think the opposition to it is really growing because people are seeing what actually happens, and obviously it's shocking.
What do you think has been driving that trend?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I think the war on drugs really probably started it, but that was a long time ago, 40 years, and it's been a slow growth since then. The best I can figure is the police like doing it. It's a lot more exciting and a lot more to brag about with their families and friends than writing speeding tickets or investigating auto burglaries or something boring like that. They really get into it. They love the toys that they get from the, especially military surplus with the tanks and armored vehicles and the armor they wear when they're breaking down people's doors. I think, they get a taste of it. They like it more, and it just continues to grow.
Now, when I was looking at some of the types of equipment that local police departments are getting, I ran across a reference to a very small police department in a small town out in Rhode Island that only has a population of maybe about 28,000 people in the town. And apparently they wound up getting 30 M16 rifles, over 600 M16 magazines with over 18,000 rounds of ammo, 44 bayonets and 12 Humvees, all from federal law enforcement grants going to local law enforcement agencies. What on earth would a local, a small town police force need that many Humvees and bayonets and M16s for?
Well, of course they don't. Rhode Island is and it doesn't just happen that it's Rhode Island, it's everywhere. But they, obviously, as a small town in a tiny little state, if they needed something like that, they could call on somebody nearby. They could have possibility of something like this every 100 miles or something rather than every little town. But, of course, that's just ridiculous.
Have we seen that happen here in Missouri as well, where even in Missouri and Kansas, small law enforcement agencies are loading up on this type of equipment?
Absolutely. It's easy for them to get. It's military surplus. They get it free a lot of times, or they buy it with the money they've seized through civil asset forfeiture. But, yeah, it's just as common here in the middle of the country as it is anywhere else.
Now, I always, anytime I see something like that, I always try to follow the money, because I usually find that money seems to lie at the root of virtually everything. To what extent have grants from the federal government maybe led to or fueled this crazy acquisition of all of this paramilitary equipment by police forces?
Well, I think to a very large extent, it's really, I don't think it could exist without that. And, you know, we could get far afield here, but I think the defense contractors want to keep selling things. The government wants to keep them happy for whatever political reasons. They want to get rid of they have to get rid of the old stuff to buy new stuff, so they grant it or sell it very cheaply to these police agencies who are enamored with it and snatch it up.
Now, one of the items that I ran across was something called the Burn Grant Program that the federal government has. And I understand that back, in fact, going back through most of the Clinton years while he was the president, annual funding was about $500 million a year that was going to essentially pay for this kind of equipment for local law enforcement agencies. And then it dropped down almost to about $170 million a year during the Bush administration. It suddenly exploded again with the Obama administration, with over, you know, $2 billion being funneled to, you know, through this grant program. Why do you have any thoughts at all on maybe why that program is so popular and why the federal government is just pouring that much money into the local law enforcement agencies?
Well, the first time I heard about that or read about that, I was very surprised that, I mean, you might think it would have been the other way around with the Democrats not being so in love with it and the Republicans more, but it seems to be the other way around for whatever reason. I don't know the root of it. I could only speculate on the political reasons, and I suspect that's what it would have to be, political reasons to keep political factions happy. But it does seem strange that it's that Obama kicked it up so high.
Now, a lot of that has come about with the whole growth in the Homeland Security Department or the Homeland Security Agency. Is that also your understanding?
Yeah, I think all this stuff really kicked into gear after 9/11 when Homeland Security was formed, and obviously tensions were high and everybody thought they needed to be prepared for a terrorist attack. I think people have calmed down a lot since then, but the police agencies certainly don't want to give up their expensive war toys.
Well, one of the things I found that was really kind of interesting was back in 2008, I was reading about a potential cut in these grant fundings going to the local law enforcement agencies. And one of the interesting things that happened was that various drug task forces across the country decided to hold a major public relations blitz, and they did a whole series of coordinated drug raids that they were using to highlight how effective these grants were. And apparently, in Kentucky alone, in a 24-hour period, the police then uncovered like 23 meth labs, you know, over a couple tons of marijuana, and arrested nearly 600 people in a 24-hour period as part of a big PR blitz. It just, does it seem strange to you that they can suddenly all of a sudden discover all of these things going on to basically make a political point?
Well, I suppose it should, and it would to most people, but nothing really surprises me anymore. Yeah, you would think if they knew about the existence of 24 meth labs, they would have gotten on them sooner than waiting for a political opportunity. I suppose meth labs in Kentucky are not very hard to find, back then especially, but even today and in most of the country, for that matter. But it certainly shows that they're not above being opportunistic.
You're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM. This is Robin Martinez. I'm a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. And with me today is Kansas City criminal defense lawyer Brian Leininger. And we are talking about militarization of the police forces across the country and also here in Missouri and Kansas as well. We've talked about the tremendous growth in the use of sort of military equipment and paramilitary forces by local law enforcement agencies. I'm presuming some things can go radically wrong when you have very heavily armed police for what should be routine law enforcement operations. I mean, have there been some examples around of things that have been botched or uses of power that have occurred because of this?
Absolutely, and it happens all the time. Some very common things would be the police would get a search warrant and they'd get their paramilitary force together to knock the door in, and they routinely and frequently get the wrong house. So they'll bust down the door and come in screaming in their full armor, and there will be some poor person sitting there not knowing what's going on. There have been a lot of circumstances where those people have had heart attacks, or those people think they're being the victim of a home invasion and don't know who these masked people are coming in, and pull a gun, with the result, obviously, that they get shot a million times by the officers coming in. Absolutely innocent people. That's bad enough. Even if they're raiding the house they intended to raid, some of those people will pull a gun to defend their 4 grams of marijuana or whatever that are in the house, and or because they think they're being raided, you know, or robbed, and they will get killed. Recently, I just read this the other day. This happened a while ago in Texas. The police kicked in the door and came in. The homeowner thought he was being burglarized and robbed, and he pulled a gun and shot and killed one of the officers. Went to a grand jury and tried to indict that man for murdering the officer, and the grand jury said no, which was very surprising and a great result, I think. They totally believed, the grand jury did, that this man reasonably thought he was being robbed and reasonably shot at the people coming in. Now, it's a shame that that officer was killed. It's one more result, a needless death in this circumstance. And again, in that case, they found a little bit of marijuana in the house or something. And then another thing just recently in Ankeny, Iowa, just up the road, a couple of hours, this one got some national press. The Ankeny is a town on the outskirts of Des Moines. It's a small town, but they had a SWAT team. They wanted to go in, and I think they were looking for somebody who was producing fraudulent credit cards or something. Instead of knocking on the door and looking for it, they broke the door down and went in there, and I think they shot the family dog and tore up the house, and again found very little evidence of crime. It happens all the time.
So that really seems that it's really a proportionality issue. I mean, is there any justification for the police to come in that type of a manner, that heavily armed, as opposed to just simply knocking at the door with a warrant?
Occasionally there is. If they have knowledge or good belief that the fellow who just robbed the bank and shot the bank guard is hiding out in there, I think, you know, that's a pretty good use of something like that. Or if they think major criminal is in there, they've got good evidence that that person would be willing to defend himself with least lethal force, then I think that's the time that this sort of thing would be used. But that's very rare, and that doesn't happen very often. Every little town has this force, and if they have it, they're going to use it. So they use it in circumstances where all they had to do is knock on the door, you know, police search warrant, and they'll either get let in or they can then enter the place. But there aren't that many circumstances where that type of force is necessary or should be used, so they use it in a lot of circumstances where it shouldn't.
Now, you mentioned the grand jury that refused to indict the homeowner who shot the police officer during one of these raids. Are we maybe starting to see a situation where maybe the courts or the public is maybe starting to look a little bit more critically at how the police are conducting their activities?
I think so, in some circumstances anyway. Like we mentioned, that things that used to be done in secret and hidden from public view can't be hidden anymore because of the fact that everyone has a video camera in their pocket, and a lot more things are being videoed now that used to go unknown. So I think a lot more people are becoming aware of the horrors that are created by this. I think the fact that it was a grand jury means a lot, too. It's a bunch of citizens who can see it and be reasonable about it. Most of these cases are taken to the local prosecutor, who works with the local police departments every day, and the last thing that prosecutor is going to do when an officer is shot is say, no, I think it was justified, I'm not going to prosecute. The prosecutor is always going to charge that case. This happened to be a grand jury, and made up of local citizens, and they are not as biased as the prosecutor would be.
Well, that's interesting, because a lot of the times we hear that the grand jury process is very susceptible to abuse. The old joke being that you could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. In this case, it seems to have actually worked out in favor of the citizens.
It did, and I don't know the political background of that particular case. Sometimes the prosecutor doesn't want to be in the position of making that decision. If he thought it was justified but didn't want to upset the police department that he works with every day, he could have maybe taken it to a grand jury to protect himself, or another similar thing would be to bring in a special prosecutor to make that decision so he or she wouldn't have to do it. I don't know the background of that case. That is the old joke that a grand jury would, if the police and prosecutors want an indictment, they're going to do it. So I think they saw exactly what happened here, and it worked well.
Now, one of the other topics that we've looked at when it comes to the militarization of the police is not just what they're doing in individual raids, but I know on this show we've had a number of other discussions where we've talked with guests about the use of a very militaristic type tactics against people trying to express their First Amendment rights and against protesters. Do you have any particular thoughts on how the militarization of the police may affect people's individual rights of expression and First Amendment rights?
Well, it seems to me that that sort of abuse has become a lot more prevalent since the police agencies have taken on a more militarized view. As I certainly remember when I was young, and I bet you do too, we thought of police officers as being our friends and as being the people we would turn to if we were in danger. I find myself in the position now of, I don't tell my kids to not talk to police or avoid police, but that's not the first place to look when you're if you need help. If my teenage sons are pulled over for a traffic ticket, my first thought is, okay, now they're going to shake them down looking for drugs or looking for beer or whatever in the car, worried about how they're going to be treated, rather than thinking, well, the police officer is going to take their action and go on the way. I think I'm getting off the topic here, but anyway, I think the mindset in police agencies has really changed. Where before, and when I was young, and even when I 20 years ago, when I was a young prosecutor, a lot of the idea was police are there to help you, they're there to serve you. Their first option is to befriend you, to diffuse a situation through language, and I've seen it changing. Of course, that happens still, and there are a lot of good police officers still, but there are a lot more who've taken the us against them attitude, where any citizen they encounter is not their neighbor, it's their enemy. And so when somebody's protesting, rather than letting them express their constitutional rights, they, as we saw with all the Occupy movement in the last couple of years, hose him down with pepper spray, or wait till you think nobody's looking and kick him in the head. And I've seen videos of all these things. I just think, unfortunately, a lot of police officers are developing that mindset, and it's a bad way to go.
Now, do you think it's the availability of the military-style equipment and essentially the costuming that they take on through that may be driving that? Or is it some other mentality within the police departments that's driving that change of attitude?
Well, I think it all goes hand in hand. It's hard to say which one sparked it and which things are growing up together and which one's the cause and which one is the result. But I think they're all growing up together. The war on drugs, the militarization of police, and then the general attitude of police, rather than helping my friends, keeping peace in my community, to going out into the war zone and finding my enemies and treating everybody I encounter as a suspect rather than assuming the best in them, they assume the worst in them. I'd have to think more, I guess, about what's the cause and what's the effect, but they're certainly all hand in hand.
How do you think that, or what's the ultimate impact you think that has on the ability of law enforcement agencies to ultimately do what they should be doing, and that is trying to fight crime or solve crimes?
Well, it's got a terrible effect. It's got a hindrance. Police used to count on people in the neighborhood to come to them, say, hey, I think there's a problem in this house over here, or you might want to look at this store, or I've seen this guy hanging around this outside the convenience store. You may want to take a look at him. Citizens don't go to the police anymore because they're afraid to. They're afraid if they go up to them, they're going to get shaken down. So I think it's a major hindrance. You reminded me of another video I saw recently where a police officer in a, I think it was a public housing type situation, saw a young boy standing on his curb throwing a football up in the air and catching it himself. Didn't have anybody to play football with. So the officer parked his car and got out, and my first thought at that point was he's going to shake this poor kid down and see if he's got any marijuana in his pocket or something. But he played catch with the kid, and I was just so warmed by that, thinking that's the way it ought to be. Now he's got a kid in the neighborhood who's got a positive thought about a police officer. Maybe they get to know each other's names, and maybe they'll be friends now. And that's the way it ought to be. Instead, that's such a rare thing that most of the kids, if they saw the police officer park his car, they'd take off running, even if they weren't doing anything wrong. And that's terribly wrong.
Thank you very much, Brian. Those are some really good comments. You've been listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM. This is Robin Martinez. I'm a lawyer with the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, and we've been talking about militarization of police forces today with Kansas City criminal defense lawyer Brian Leininger. Thank you for being on, Brian.
Thank you very much.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following report comes to us courtesy of Fox, Houston.
A big topic from the week, the war on drugs is once again up for debate. And now the Houston Police Chief, Charles McClelland, is calling it a, quote, miserable failure. The chief made those comments during an interview on the radio show Cultural Baggage, which aired on FM 90.1 this past Friday. He says the money spent jailing low-level drug offenders would be better spent on treatment and prevention programs. Take a listen.
It costs somewhere around $50,000 to $60,000 per inmate to house one single inmate per year in Texas prisons. When you look at it just from a financial, monetary standpoint, the taxpayers can't afford to build jails and prisons to lock up everyone to commit a crime. We must put more money into crime prevention, treatment, education, job training.
So what do you think of a police chief moving away from the traditional stance on drugs? That's our topic this half hour. Joining us live in the newsroom is our roundup panel led by our Fox 26 legal analyst, Chris Tritico. Hey, Chris, good morning again.
Good morning.
Was this surprising to you to hear these kinds of comments coming from a major city police chief?
Well, I think he's the first chief of police that I've heard in the country that came out and said this. It's not surprising because we have been moving this direction for the last couple of years now. I think it's very gutsy of Chief McClelland to acknowledge that our focus the last 30 years on low-level drug offenders as opposed to those people who are creating the problem is an abysmal failure. And we have created an entire class of individuals who are convicted of misdemeanors and felonies, preventing them from getting jobs, preventing them from getting higher education degrees, and creating a subculture of people who can't advance. And that's what Chief McClellan's talking about. Aside from the tax money that we spend housing low-level drug offenders, this subculture of people that we are forcing that to work low-level jobs the rest of their lives is something we will be paying for a very long time. Let me introduce our panel, Mustafa Tamiz, our political analyst, Jackie Valley, our public policy analyst. We've seen the war on drugs. About 30 years ago, we started this war on drugs, maybe 40 years now. And instead of going after the people selling the drugs, the people bringing the drugs in, we started arresting the people using the drugs. And we've got this whole class of people now that are convicted. And Chief McClellan says this isn't working.
Well, if you look at the numbers, it's staggering. Every 50 minutes in Harris County, we arrest somebody for possession. That's almost 11,000 cases. Texas, just in, enforcement spends $250 million. So the math of this is what's driving it.
Yeah, folks, figure it out. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three.
What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow.
We hope you enjoy today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Jessica Thomas, host of Before the Dawn on Sunday morning from 4 to 7 a.m. Our outro music is Better Man from the Plan for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beauticious Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and Eco Radio, KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta musical. I can, and if I